Hello, I'm Alain Marcil. This is number 0284, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0284. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a return visit from Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Nevada, who is also the author of The Art of the Pimp. Why write this book now?
I'm asked every day, you know, what do I teach my girls to keep husbands coming back here and spending a lot of money? And so I'm doing a tell-all. I'm telling all about the business, the insides of it, lots of funny stories of me and Ron Jeremy, because he's my little buddy, and a lot of crazy antics with rock stars. And so I'm telling all that. I'm telling the girls what they need to do to step up their game, if you will. And it's going to be a bestseller.
David Doc Grayson is the author of Handwriting Secrets Revealed, the book on handwriting analysis. Many companies are into handwriting analysis these days. Is this a trend?
No, it has been for quite a while. It's increased over the number of years, but they don't advertise it because they don't really want people to know that. But anytime you go to an interview and they ask, do you write something about yourself or about the company in your own handwriting, you know for sure that they're going to analyze that handwriting. And often it's not necessarily to keep you out of the job, but to find the best fit for you within the organization.
Fantasy sports expert Tony Cotillo on people who are addicted to fantasy sports. Do people get addicted to the fantasy leagues that are just for fun, or with the ones that offer the chance to win big money?
I think it might be a little of both, but I would lean towards where the money becomes involved, because you can fall from anywhere from as little as $100 to $10,000. And it becomes an addiction when you start hiding money from your significant other, having separate bank accounts. There's national websites like FanDuel and DraftKings nowadays where you can set up a bank account, link your PayPal account to it, where you just make numerous transactions over the course of a week.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0284 was Alain Marcil, who is the chief engineer at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. And thank you very much, sir, Alain, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Authorities in Minnesota say they are looking into whether an elderly woman was already dead when her son brought her to the bank for an $850 withdrawal. Police say David Vanzo of Plymouth reported his mother, Carol Vanzo, dead just days shy of her 91st birthday about 2 weeks ago, and officers were greeted at the home by the stench of urine and feces. The woman's body was clothed in a robe, fur coat, and boots that were covered in excrement, police say. Vanzo, who was arrested and charged with elderly neglect, was found to have visited the bank with his mother just 7 hours before reporting her death. He withdrew $850 from his mother's account, police said. Investigators say they are looking into whether Carol Vanzo was dead when her son took her into the bank. Witnesses at the bank said the woman's feet were dragging under her wheelchair, and Vanzo's neighbors said they wondered whether the mother was dead or unconscious when she was being taken from her house to a taxi cab. David Vanzo had previously been investigated by social workers on allegations of financially exploiting his mother. Police visited the home in 2012 and found Carol Vanzo was lucid and wanted to stay in the home with her son. David Vanzo denied the allegations against him and said the money he withdrew was from a joint account. "I love my mother very much," he told a local television station. "I gave my life to keep my mother alive. Look into my eyes." What, is he trying to hypnotize people now? Okay, I know Weekend at Bernie's is only a movie, but I have to ask the question, Didn't the cab driver get a whiff of any kind of funky smell while Mom was in the back of the cab on the way to the bank? I mean, I know in some cities a cab might actually smell bad, but seriously, enough to overpower the stench of death? Come on. And, okay, right off the bat with this next story, I have to say, this really, really, really makes me see red. I know we're only into the first month of the year, but I find it hard to believe that there is another story in the calendar year of 2015 that is going to be more asinine than this one. Are you ready? Here we go. Alex Nash, a 5-year-old from Cornwall, England, has been billed for skipping a classmate's birthday party at the Ski Slope and Snowboard Center in Plymouth. Alex's father, Derek, told the Plymouth Herald that his son came home with a 15-pound invoice last week. That's just about $24 U.S. It had been passed on to him by Julie Lawrence, the mother of the classmate whose birthday he missed. I thought it was a joke to begin with, and I am lost for words, said Derek. He went on to say that Alex had agreed to go to the party, but remembered too late that his son had made plans to spend the day with his grandparents. He said he didn't have any way of getting in contact with the Lawrence family. Lawrence told the BBC News that Alex and his family had her contact information. All details were on the party invite. They had every detail needed to contact me. Derek told Lawrence that he refused to pay the bill because of the way Lawrence broached the issue. I told her that she should have spoken to me first and not put the invoice in my son's school bag, he said. I would have sympathized with her about the cost of Alex not showing up, but I just can't believe the way she has gone about it. Derek said Lawrence threatened to take her to small claims court. I think that bears repeating. Derek said Lawrence threatens to take him to small claims court and that her child wouldn't be allowed to play with Alex at school, though Derek's partner is attempting to mediate this dispute. Okay. I'm going to address my comments to Julie Lawrence here. Julie, what kind of delusional, anal-retentive, control freak party planner from hell are you? If you would send an invoice to the parents of a 5-year-old because said child didn't show up to your little shindig, then you must truly believe the sun rises and sets on you and the fruit of your loins. We're talking about a birthday party for a 5-year-old. You weren't planning a royal wedding or a presidential inauguration or New Year's Eve in Times Square. And if this is the kind of trouble you want to cause for a kid who didn't show up, I can just imagine the lack of fun your overplanned jubilee for your offspring must have been. Julie, get a grip. And join the rest of us on this side of reality. A party invitation for Rugrats is not a legally binding contract, and legal minds in Britain have already weighed in and so much has said so. Plus, threatening to prevent your child from playing with Alex? If this is how you are with your kid at 5, how will you be with him at 15? I think this is how Norman Bates' mother started, and we all know how that turned out. Don't we? Don't get too attached to the basement. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Dennis Hoff is the owner of the famed Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Carson City, Nevada. We've had the chance to talk to him on several occasions over the years. Well, this time around, we're actually celebrating Dennis. The Moonlight Bunny Ranch is celebrating its 60th anniversary in February. And Dennis, who is also known as the P.T. Barnum of Booty, has a new book out called The Art of the Pimp, which comes out in March. Dennis joins us on the line from the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Nevada right now. Hi, Dennis.
Good evening, Peter. It's always fun. And I've got a special guest for you tonight, Chrissy Summers, the beautiful University of Michigan cheerleader that turned bunny and paid off her school loans and working here, and now she's getting her doctorate.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Hi, Chrissy. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me on.
So how long have you been at the Bunny Ranch?
I actually started over a year ago. I paid off my student loans just after a few months, actually. So I was $45,000 in debt, paid off my school loans, and now I'm actually going to a school in San Francisco, so I'm going to be getting my doctorate in human sexuality. So in a year and a half, I'll be able to, you know, go around the world, give speeches. I'll be able to even go to universities and actually be a professor if I wanted to. But, I'm really excited about that.
Now, how did you first learn about the Bunny Ranch?
Actually, I grew up in a really religious home, but one night when my parents were sleeping, I turned on HBO and I saw Dennis on his show Cat House. And I actually got in trouble for watching it, so my parents found out and they put parental blocks on, and I was grounded for like 3 months just because that wasn't exactly what they wanted me to watch. I was just like the church girl. They sent me to church every week, so I discovered him when I was 14 years old.
Oh, wow. Which brings me back to you, Dennis. I got to ask the question, how many church girls are at the Bunny Ranch? Because I get the feeling that's not an unusual story.
Well, she's unusual because she's just real special. But there are many girls. I mean, every weekend the limo goes out to different churches and drops girls off. And I think it's great to see the Bunny Ranch limo and the response that people get because that's not what they think. I mean, the image of prostitution in North America is underage, ethnic, short shorts, street corner, crack pipe, and a pimp down the street. And when you legalize this business, it totally changes that, Peter. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about your book, The Art of the Pimp. You've been around in this business for quite some time now. What made you write this book now?
I just felt like it was time. It was just time to tell the story. It's a very unique story with lots of fun stories. I'm asked every day, you know, what do I teach my girls to keep husbands coming back here and spending a lot of money? And so I'm doing a tell-all. I'm telling all about the business, the insides of it, lots of funny stories of me and Ron Jeremy, because he's my little buddy, and a lot of crazy antics with rock stars. And so I'm telling all that. I'm telling the girls what they need to do to step up their game, if you will. And it's going to be a bestseller. And if people buy enough of it pre-sale, which you can buy now on Barnes & Noble or Amazon, it's going to be a movie too, hopefully.
Now, we've had a chance to talk to you about various things over the years and various aspects of running the Moonlight Bunny Ranch. But I don't think I ever asked you how you got into this in the first place.
Well, Peter, you know, everything evolves around sex. I met a girl in Reno and started dating her. And, of course, she was a great lover. And then eventually she told me the truth that she worked at the Moonlight Ranch. And the Moonlight Ranch is now the Moonlight Bunny Ranch. She talked me into coming out to take a look at it. And when I got out here, I thought, well, this is pretty normal, except for the part where we're selling sex like McDonald's sells Big Macs. And then I met Andy Kaufman, the famed comedian, and his partner Bob Zamuda. And we just got to be buddies and hung around here a lot. And one night in about 78, Kaufman says, you know, Dennis, you ought to buy this place and treat everybody like you and I are being treated. You because you're a boyfriend, me because I'm a celebrity. And that just set in, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to do this. So I went to work on it, and the place has been here since 1955. It's our 60th year anniversary. And I ended up buying it in 1992 and turned it into the most famous place in the world.
Well, what were you doing before you became, as your book so states, a pimp?
I was doing real estate development. And so I was a real estate guy and did very well in that. But I'll tell you, when you're surrounded by hot women every day and most of them love sex and a few of them had a little too much to drink, your life's pretty good.
I was about to ask, is there ever a day where you say to yourself, you know, I really don't feel like going to work today?
Never. Never, never, never.
He's so happy in the morning. Like, seriously, he'll, you know, get calls from radio shows at like 4:30 in the morning, and he'll be sleeping, and then he'll pick up the phone, and he'll be like, good morning, just like out of a dead sleep. That's like how positive he is every day when he wakes up.
I'm laying next to you, a gorgeous blonde, stunning blonde, and you can see lots of pictures of Chrissy on my Twitter feed, at Chrissy, at Dennis Hoff, or at Chrissy Summers 88. She's a beautiful, beautiful blonde, and yeah, you know, if I didn't know better, I'd think you were from Canada because you have that kind of look, that beautiful blonde look. You speak well. You're somewhat conservative. Yeah.
Somewhat.
Well, I'm close to Canada. I'm from Michigan.
Somewhat conservative, Chrissy. So your church-going parents, are they still breathing?
Yeah, they are. And you know what? I still have those, you know, church roots in me. I don't go to, you know, church on a regular basis anymore. However, I did go for the Christmas service. So I still have those conservative Christian Midwest roots in me that'll never die.
I guess the moral of the story is the blocking on television doesn't really work, does it, eh, Chrissy?
It doesn't. You know what? Shoving religion down a girl's throat is just going to make them come to the bunny ranch like I did and fall into the arms of Dennis Hoff.
I like that. I like that. And another component of my book that I just love, Peter, I'm very proud of, is that the greatest cartoonist in the world is a guy named Robert Grossman. He does all the covers of New Yorker magazine and Time magazine, all the caricatures, he does those. He read the manuscript and then did a 32-page comic book on the book, and he just nailed it. It's just phenomenal. So, and that's a part of my book now, 32-page comic book that's a pullout.
Okay, so the Bunny Ranch is celebrating its 60th anniversary, but you've only run the place for about half that time.
Right.
So it's had it's been pretty successful as a legal brothel for the first 30 years or so, but you have turned it into something that is literally world famous. What is it that you did? What did you bring to the Bunny Ranch that made it what it is today, as opposed to what it had been before you had it?
Right, because remember, it was illegal is from 1955 to 1972. When it opened up, and then legal from 72 to 92 when I bought it. I think the things that I've done is used generally accepted business practices. I make it fun, and the motto is the world famous Moonlight Bunny Ranch, not just sex and adventure. So I made it more about the fun, more about the travel, and maybe less about the destination. In other words, it's not just sex, it's the adventure. It's the dating, it's having fun, it's getting to know girls, and that interaction is priceless.
And I know when I first spoke to you years ago on the old radio show, I did ask you this question, so I'll ask you it again, and that is, do you ever foresee a time when prostitution is legal, in not just where you are in Carson City, Nevada, but across the United States?
I think it's really difficult for the politicians, because they're such hypocrites. They don't want to irritate that one little old Christian lady that's going to get very boisterous. And I've seen it in Canada. You know, I was so excited about coming to Canada and opening up in Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver. But once the lawmakers got a hold of it, they didn't want to deal with the flack of the right wing. So now the laws are even worse, and it's even more dangerous for the girls. And a customer can be arrested for trying to buy sex in Canada now.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. Depends. It depends on what jurisdiction you're in. There's certain laws that are different in certain places.
Well, the Fed law.
Yeah,
the Fed law is using the Norwegian model. And basically saying, no, don't buy sex. The girls are all victims, and if you try to buy sex, you're going to go to jail. And so what they've done is they've driven it way underground and made it extremely dangerous for everybody.
You mentioned politicians being hypocrites, and I know you've talked about this in the past. You see your fair share of politicians at your establishment, don't you?
Oh, that's why we have a back door and we have blacked-out limousines so they can get picked up at a restaurant someplace, brought out here in the back door into a private VIP suite where some celebrities enjoy going to, and then the girls are brought to them. So nobody sees them. Nobody sees them, and they come in and have their fun and get on home.
Again, the book is, you have the book out called The Art of the Pimp, and that is, it comes out in March, but as you say, you can pre-order the book right now, correct?
Absolutely. The pre-sales are going very, very well, and I'm really excited. I'm very proud of this book, and it's a tell-all. There's some juicy stories in there, some crazy antics of things that happened at the ranch, and I even allowed every girlfriend I've ever had in the last 23 years the opportunity to write a chapter unedited and put it in the book. And some of them don't like me too much, Peter.
Tell me, Chrissy, have you read it?
I haven't read the whole book yet, which I'm really looking for. I ordered a bunch for my friends and family, of course. I haven't read the whole story. I do have an interview in there that'll be in the book that I have read that Jonas has not read. So he'll look forward to reading that, I guess, too.
Well, we look forward to the book. Again, the book is called The Art of the Pimp. It's written by Dennis Hoff. And Dennis, I thank you once again for being on the program with us. Congratulations to the 60 years of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch and the book coming out.
60 years of hips, lips, and fingertips, Peter. And hopefully it'll be another 60 more.
Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Nevada, along with Chrissy Summers. You can see his HBO show, Cat House. Check your local listings for that. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0284, and you'll find links to Dennis's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Handwriting Secrets Revealed. Plus, we'll meet a fantasy sports expert who will be on to talk about fantasy sports addiction. But first, we have more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Oh, and I almost forgot, yes, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Okay, back to the news. After leaving the party marking her promotion at work, police say 43-year-old Monique Smith confronted John James near his Newark, New Jersey home. She yelled, he drove away. She drove into his car repeatedly, authorities say. Eventually, James, who, by the way, is a city councilman, got to his father's home where Sharp James, a former mayor, intervened for his son. Smith was arrested, and authorities say domestic violence prosecutors will handle the case, along with those specializing in professional standards. Smith's promotion, you remember that she was at a party for that, was to police captain in nearby Irvington. Michael Chase, Irvington's police chief, said Smith was suspended along with her paycheck, and he urged people not to infer that the incident means that every cop is bad. Yes, indeed. Someone was arrested, that being Smith, and someone suspended her without pay. Nothing to see here. Meanwhile, 36-year-old Elizabeth Ferguson had a great week. She was hired as a teacher at S.P. Morton Elementary School in Franklin, Virginia, and allowed to report to work to start teaching first grade pending a background check. It sure beat the previous week when she had been arrested on two felony warrants charging her with distributing heroin a year before. School officials didn't bother filing the background check request with the police department for a month, and it took 3.5 weeks for the state police to process it. When results finally came back 2 weeks after that, Ferguson was suspended with pay. By then, she had already been in the classroom for more than 2 months. Ferguson resigned, effective when her paid suspension was over. Yeah. Okay, suddenly I feel kind of sorry for Monique Smith from that last story. I mean, she's only a cop in a domestic dispute who was suspended without pay. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Ferguson, the newly minted first grade teacher and alleged heroin dealer, gets to keep her taxpayer-funded salary. Doesn't seem quite fair now, does it? Yeah. Meanwhile, Britain's Home Office directed in January that the UK's nursery school staff report pupils at risk of becoming terrorists, but gave little guidance on what teachers and managers should look for. According to a description of the directive in the Daily Telegraph, staffs must have training that gives them the knowledge and confidence to identify children at risk of being drawn into terrorism and challenge extremist ideas. Excuse me? Jihadist toddlers? Really? Can any reaction be more knee-jerk than that one? Yeah. Moving right along, after a car hit a pole in La Crosse, Wisconsin, just after 2 a.m., police checked the driver to see if he was drunk. 30-year-old Kong P. Vu had been moving his arms up and down while complaining that he couldn't move them, but officers still asked him to recite the alphabet. Here's what he said. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, G, K, I'm gonna kill all y'all. The officers stopped the test and arrested Vu, who later registered a blood alcohol level of 0.188% on the breath test. He was charged with his fourth offense, drunk driving, driving with a revoked license, because they always have a revoked license in these stories, don't they? And he was also charged with hit and run. However, to be fair, you know, we don't really know if he knows the alphabet when he's sober, never mind drunk. And let's be honest, how many of you really don't know it without singing that song? Come on, let me see a show of hands here. Okay. There is no single answer to what to do in the event an active shooter invades a school. This according to U.S. Department of Education guidelines. But a survivalist mindset can increase the odds of surviving. In that spirit, Priscilla Hawley, principal of W.F. Burns Middle School in Chambers County, Alabama, decided her students should be armed. This way, they could surprise intruders and help protect themselves. They could feel empowered. So she sent a letter to parents asking them to supply their sons and daughters with the latest in school-approved weaponry, 8-ounce cans of food, 1 can per student, that they could throw at any school shooter trying to kill them. Okay, well, in theory, I suppose a can of baked beans skipping off your noggin would leave a deliriously inducing gash or two, but is it enough to arm all children with cans? Don't you have to teach them how to effectively throw the cans? I mean, if you're going to go that far? Seriously. Wow. Anyway, and finally in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the results of the 22nd World Pie Eating Championships were declared null and void after a delivery error in Wigan, which is in Greater Manchester, England. The problem? There were two large orders for meat and potato pies from the supplier, Harry's Bar. The official competition pie is specified to have a diameter of 12 centimeters and a depth of 3.5 centimeters, with the meat and potato pieces a minimum of 1 centimeter cubes with 66% meat content, not including pastry. Now, those pies went to the wrong place, and the championship got the other order with pies that were about twice as large. The work experience lad was tasked with providing 24 competition pies, but mixed up the order and sent them to a divorce party up the road, said Tony Callahan, the owner of Harry's Bar. By the time we realized, it was too late. So, the divorce party got half the pie they ordered. Well, just like the couple in question, I guess. Seems kind of fair when you think about it, doesn't it? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This past Friday was National Handwriting Day. David Doc Grayson has been a teacher for more than 40 years and is the author of Handwriting Secrets Revealed, the book on handwriting analysis. He joins us on the line right now from Illinois. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. In looking at some of the information, I've noticed that a lot of companies seem to be into handwriting analysis. Has this always been the way, or is this a trend?
No, it has been for quite a while. It's increased over the number of years. But they don't advertise it. They don't, you know, broadcast it around because they don't really want people to know that. But anytime you go to an interview and they ask for some, do you write something about yourself or about the company in your own handwriting, you know for sure that they're going to analyze that handwriting. And often it's not necessarily to keep you out of a job, but to find the best fit for you within the organization. Because if you want a secretary, you want somebody to be multitasked and everything else. But if you're looking for somebody to just file all day, you don't want some person that's easily distracted because they've got to do a specific job. So it's really kind of to find the best person for the best job.
So just how much does one's handwriting tell about them?
It tells an awful lot. There's about a little over 144 traits we can find. Not all of them are in every handwriting, but you can find persistence, temper, goal setting, how you think and how you learn, your emotional response to this. Do you deal with your head or do you deal with your heart? Just so many things can be found in the writing.
We are now living in a world where everybody has some sort of personal computer, from cell phones to laptops to tablets, and it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, that there is less and less writing these days, or at least less and less regular writing, so that people don't write as much as they used to. Does that change how the analysis works?
Well, you're 100% correct on that, because it's not even being taught in many schools anymore. So everybody's using an iPad or, like you said, a keyboard. But there's some states of the United States are going back to teaching cursive. They still do up in Canada, they teach cursive. But they're finding more and more in studies with the brain, how the brain reacts to cursive writing and the neural pathways that it creates. And they're finding a strong correlation between lack of hand-eye coordination with people who haven't learned writing and people who have learned to do cursive, that the eye-hand coordination is much better in those people who learn cursive. But it is slowly coming back. People still need it. The sad thing is we've gone through kind of a 10, 15-year period where you have fine high school students that can't print or can't read cursive. I always laugh. They go through school, they can learn to curse, but they don't learn cursive.
Now, one of the things we always talk about often is the fact that doctors have such bad handwriting. Is there a reason for that?
Well, part of it, I'd hate to be a pharmacist, that's for sure. But doctors, for the most part, you know, that's code and Latin and those kinds of things. That's why it's sometimes hard to read. But it's the reason doctors do it, and really CEOs, head of corporations, often have the same type of writing. Their brain is working so fast, for them to slow down and write carefully and write cautiously, they can't do that because they've got five or six patients waiting for them. They've got to run to the hospital for something. They've got to do this for something. They've got to write this report. So the faster the writing, the faster the brain is moving. So that's why the doctors have the sloppy writing. Sometimes you'll find that doctors, when they're doing their own personal information or writing a personal note or something, the writing is totally different because now they're in a relaxed mode. But when they're writing, you know, for the pharmacist and notes on the patients, it's usually just scribble, and that makes it very difficult, of course.
Now, before talking to you, when I was booking this interview with you, I sent you a copy of my own handwriting, which is not cursive. And I confess that I gave up cursive writing in grades 8 and convinced my teachers that if you want to read what I'm writing, I think it's more important that you get my grammar than get my cursive, because my writing is terrible. So I've been printing since I was 13.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that, because that's a type of a mind that likes things simple and clear, and this is what I said. I want you to understand it. I want you to be able to read what I wrote. I'm not trying to be a phony. I'm not trying to be fake. It's just good. A lot of electricians and technical people have, you know, print a lot. But it's a good printing. It's a very nice printing, and it's good, clean thought and straight-up thought.
And to be honest, I was actually very surprised when you wrote back an email telling me what you thought of my handwriting, what it says about me. I was kind of surprised at how I found it relatively accurate.
Yeah, that's the thing. It still scares me in a way, too, that it is so accurate. And sometimes I think, well, it's got to be phony. And then I'll do an analysis of somebody, and they look at you like, how do you know all that stuff? But it's just, it works. It's amazing, but it does work.
How did you get into handwriting analysis in the first place?
Well, about 45 years ago, I was at a restaurant, and some man came with my family. I was in college at the time, graduate school. And a gentleman came around and said for $2 he would analyze our handwriting. So for a lark, we did that. And I was, there was four of us. I was the last one. And he told me things about myself that I couldn't believe. How, you know, what family member told you that? Because I'm a very private person. And I was taking courses at Loyola, in my graduate courses in guidance and counseling. And I thought, you know, they talk about different ways to find out about people. And I kept going back to, you know, is handwriting serious? Is it, does it work? So I looked up in the phone book, excuse me, there's an organization in Chicago, International Graphical Analysis Society. It was at the time in Chicago, and contacted them, went to their offices, and the guy analyzed my writing, and I was sold on the spot, and I took the course and became certified a year and a half later, and I've been doing it ever since. It's been really helped in my teaching, because you can, you know how to approach a child where you need, you know, some children want you to repeat things 20 times just to drive you crazy. And some people need to hear that 2 + 2 = 4 20 times. And in writing, you know which students really need that repetition over and over again.
That's very interesting. Now, your book is called Handwriting Secrets Revealed, the book on handwriting analysis. What is it you want the general population to know about what you do and what handwriting analysis can show them?
Well, it's just a lot of different ways it could be used. Like we're talking about now, personality profiles. We use it a lot with children to help them to develop better. As I talked about earlier, hiring the right person. Maybe you want to marry somebody or dating somebody or want to go into partnership with somebody, and you really would like to have your handwriting and their handwriting analyzed to find out if you're a good fit. And that's, again, not necessarily to say you're not a good fit, but to find the strengths and weaknesses in each and where you can help each other. Also in genealogy, you know, we can look up and find out everything about our ancestors except their personality. But if you can find a little bit of their writing or their signature, then we can put kind of a personality onto that picture of the person you have. So there's a lot of different ways it can be used. More and more now it's used in jury selection. Attorneys can will use it to pick jurors.
Wow, interesting. Now, how much, if any, does your handwriting change over the years along with your personality? Does it change as you age?
Yes, it sure does. Like when you switch to printing, there is a big change over the four. Now, some people don't. Some people are boring. You know, the way they were when they were 18, that's the way they are in 48 and 68. But most people change over life. They have different environments and different associations, so they do change, and the handwriting does change. Some people have changed slowly, and some people, they notice changes during the day that, you know, they can, you know, change a lot, because some people get irritable different times of the day and frustrated different times of the day. So, yes, it does change. The basic personality is there, but a lot of little side things change. So if you have, you know, some people say, well, my handwriting changes all the time. Does that mean I'm crazy? I said, no, that pretty well means you're normal, because it's, if you think of it as brain writing, brain controls your writing. So however your brain is how it shows up for the writing. If you're in a good mood, it's going to look one way. If you're in a negative mood, you're going to look another way.
You know, it's interesting, because I've always believed that. And the thing that I find very striking is so much is in our culture is predicated on our signature, which I keep looking at mine. It's not the same every time I do it. Yet, you know, I have to sign a credit card, I have to sign my driver's license, and I have to match that when I sign something else.
Right. Your signature is how you want to appear to other people. Your handwriting itself, the body of the writing, is how you really are. The signature is how you appear. That's why so many people, when we see autographs of movie stars or TV stars or sports figures, it's always real fancy, and sometimes there's even drawings in there. That's because they have a very outgoing personality because they're in the limelight. But your signature is you. So sometimes if you're signing a check to buy a house and it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, your signature is going to look a lot different than if you're endorsing your lottery winning check. So it's at the time of what you want to present to the people that you're presenting your signature to.
Fascinating stuff. The book is called Handwriting Secrets Reveal, the book on handwriting analysis. It's written by David Doc Grayson. I thank you very much, David, for being on the program with us.
Thank you. Good talking with you, and good luck to you.
David Doc Grayson, author of Handwriting Secrets Reveal, the book on handwriting analysis. You can check out his website at handwritingsecretsreveal.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0284, and you'll find the link, plus also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. What would you do if the government sent you a bill for taxes it knew you didn't owe, and then later admitted that the bill was completely phony? Well, the city of Philadelphia recently admitted that it sends tax bills with fictitious assessments to some of its residents. And surprisingly, a judge there even ruled that one man must pay his bogus bill. Why would a city send anyone a fake tax bill? In Philadelphia, officials who suspect someone is behind on paying taxes say they fabricate assessments with amounts that are really high so the person will come into their office, even though the person may have done nothing wrong. Let's be fair, it's hard to imagine a more bizarre story coming out of government. But get this, when one man challenged his fake bill and lost on a technicality, a judge actually ruled he must still pay the fictitious bill, even though she said, and I quote, "The city's strong-arm collection tactics may well lack authority in law." Unbelievable. Find out more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about sports addiction. Plus, we'll have an idiot of the day. But I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Okay, so three men watching sports on TV and playing dominoes in Cleveland, Ohio, got into an argument. One, a 48-year-old man identified only as Cowboy, accused another man, age 44, of having homosexual tendencies. That man said that several in the neighborhood had told him that Cowboy had homosexual tendencies. Outraged, Cowboy started beating on the other man until the third man broke things up. Not appeased, the two men agreed to take the fight outside. As the 44-year-old waited, Cowboy popped into his own house for a weapon and came out with a 2-foot sword. He hit the other man with the sword several times until he said that he was going to call the police. And then Cowboy just simply ran. Well, no surprise. A sword is a phallic weapon. Even less of a surprise. This one was particularly short. Anyway, let's get to our final guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Is it possible for people to be addicted to the world of fantasy sports? Tony Cotillo is a fantasy sports expert, and we put that question to him. Tony joins us on the line right now from Philadelphia. Hi, Tony.
Hey, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So, is it possible to be addicted to fantasy sports?
One word, absolutely. There's so many different varieties of the game in every facet that just keeps you glued to the screen or your digital device, your computer, your phone, whatever it may have you. It's all about being addicted.
Now, there are different kinds of people, and I'm sure different reasons for why they love fantasy sports. So can you break down the personalities of people who are into the fantasy sports?
Definitely. There's such a wide array of demographics when it comes to fantasy sports. They can be played as professional in Las Vegas. It could be played between family members where there's no money on the line. It could be a work venture through work buddies, or it could just be a thing, a friendly game amongst friends.
Now, when you're talking about ones where there's money on the line, which in a way is a form of gambling, is that where the addiction comes in, or is there addiction across the board, whether there's money or not involved?
I think it might be a little of both, but I would lean towards where the money comes, you know, becomes involved, because you can fall from anywhere from as little as $100 to $10,000, and you know it becomes an addiction when you start hiding money from your significant other, having separate bank accounts. There's national websites like FanDuel and DraftKings nowadays where you can set up a bank account, link your PayPal account to it, where you just make numerous transactions over the course of a week.
I find it very interesting that most leagues really push the idea of getting more deeply involved in that particular sport through fantasy leagues. And the reason why I find that interesting, let's use baseball for an example. I mean, we still have a situation where Pete Rose is persona non grata from the game of baseball for essentially gambling on the sport he was involved in. Yet baseball and every other league has embraced fantasy in such a way that also includes a gambling aspect. Isn't that kind of a double standard?
I completely agree. And, you know, the point for that in football, where have you, is essentially about at least 3 years ago, it was forbidden to even bring out the word fantasy football amongst the NFL officials. And now all of a sudden, it's become embraced, just like you said with baseball, where you know you have guys like Peyton Manning at their news conference saying, you know, that was for all my fantasy players out there. There's NFL players tweeting fantasy stats, you know, during halftime, during the games. I mean, it's just become a tremendous business that's been embraced, and it's been over a $10 billion industry over the last couple of years. So it's definitely a double standard when you talk about gambling.
Okay, we're talking about the addiction aspect of it from the people who are actually playing the fantasy sports, but something you just touched on, do you find in any way, shape, or form that fantasy sports is having an effect on the game itself? I mean, when you have players tweeting out their stats, it means they're cognizant of what's going on and what they're doing. Does it have an effect on the games?
I absolutely agree it does. And, you know, it's been talked about over numerous years because you become asphyxiated with the statistical data instead of the game, just like you said. I mean, you're not worried about if a team wins or loses. You're just worried about your players on the field on the court, and he gets to score his points. So it definitely does take away from the left side of the game.
Okay, you're a fantasy sports expert. So how did you get involved, and how did you get involved to the point that you went just from beyond a participant to becoming an expert?
Started around 10, 12 years ago. It just, you know, it kind of evolved. I started out when, you know, back in the day we didn't have digital devices, and the scores were, you know, kept by pen and paper, by box scores that came out on Monday morning. It started as a friendly league amongst a couple friends, and then before you know it, I became asphyxiated with it to the point of I wanted to learn more. I started evolving into other sports. I didn't like the way the standard scoring systems work, so I kind of wanted to develop my own system, and it just grew from there.
And this brings me back to what I asked the type of person that's involved, because you know I like fantasy football, for instance. But I like the analytical aspect of it. I'll give you an example. Going back in the day when I was a kid, I played Strat-O-Matic baseball, and it's because I loved the stats of it that made me a big fan of the game. You said you came up with your own scoring system. So is it the analytical part of it that you enjoy?
Definitely. And, you know, to be specific, they're very big now when you call about PPR leagues, points per reception leagues. But back in the day, the standard scoring system, it wasn't developed that way. Everybody did a standard scoring system, which I didn't think, in my own words, was fair, because I felt like there was a lot more points being left on the field. So I started the PPR. Obviously, I didn't brand it, but it was at a time where it just started to develop. And then before you know it, now everybody kind of leaned towards the PPR, and the standard scoring system is kind of in the past.
When you come across, because we're talking about addiction in fantasy sports, how should someone approach someone if they think they're dealing with someone who's an addictive personality regarding fantasy sports? What are the signs, in other words?
Well, you know, I have somebody close to me that actually was addicted to it and admitted it. And, you know, it was a good friend of mine. And, you know, it came to the point where you would try to hold an average conversation with the person, not talking about sports related, just could it be about, you know, family or friends. And they couldn't even pay attention to you because they were constantly on their phone. They were looking at updates. And before you know it, they couldn't go out to dinner with the boys because they didn't have any money because they lost too much money the night before, to the point where it caused divorce because, you know, he did go broke and he did go bankrupt based on the fact that he was spending too much time and money on these things. So it's hard. You could definitely see the telltale signs. It's not that hard to see when somebody's not paying attention to the normal everyday activity. You definitely can tell that there's something else bothering them.
You actually have a website, fantasysportsaddiction.com, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
What will you find when we go there?
Well, during football season, obviously, is one of the most popular ones. I do weekly statistical updates on what I feel my best players are for the week. I label them as stiffs and stars. And I basically write a few articles on other sports also, where it comes to baseball, basketball, hockey, and even wrestling. So there's a wide variety of topics that's updated daily on that site.
When it comes to fantasy sports, is football the granddaddy of them all, or how does baseball rank in that?
Well, we have about 41 million players right now playing fantasy football, so it definitely is the cream of the crop. But baseball, I'm not specifically sure of the numbers, but in the sense of popularity, it has definitely become a close second.
What is it that makes football the reigning king in fantasy sports?
I think football, because of the originality of it, that's basically where the whole premise surmised. But baseball, it's a longer season, so a lot of people aren't attracted to that, or attracted more to the football aspect, because it's only a weekly lineup, it's only a weekly game, as opposed to baseball being a daily activity.
Interesting stuff indeed. People can find out more information, as you mentioned. You have a website, fantasysportsaddiction.com, which, by the way, is giving information to fantasy sports enthusiasts, not necessarily talking about the addiction aspect of it, correct?
Yeah, so that's correct. It's just basically staying like that because of my own addiction to the game.
Right. And people can find out more information there. You're also a weekly – you're also a contributor to footballnation.com.
Yes, and also I'm an editorial writer for eWrestlingNews.com as well.
Okay, I know we're a little while, you know, we have a week or so away from the Super Bowl. Do you have a prediction?
It's a shame. You know, there's a lot of stories coming out. We're watching that last game, I'll definitely go with Seattle. I think Seattle's going to win their back-to-back game.
Okay, I was about to ask the question, do you have a feeling who will win, and do you have a preference of who will win? Because that's two different questions.
I'll be honest with you. I have a feeling it's Seattle, and preference is also Seattle. I think they just played their hearts out that last game. It was amazing.
I'm actually with you on that one completely. Tony, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I appreciate it.
Fantasy sports expert Tony Cotillo. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0284, and you'll find the link to Tony's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
When the wife of 57-year-old James Rivers of Kent, Washington, was about to bust him for his alleged child porn collection in October, he shipped his laptop to a technician to have the hard drive erased, but with explicit instructions that if the techie encounters a hidden file, he must not look at the photos under any circumstances. The techie, of course, found the file, looked at it, and notified authorities, and Rivers was arrested. Okay, now why? If you have photos you don't want a computer technician to see on your computer, on a hard drive you want to erase, would you even tell said technician not to look at it and actually believe that he wouldn't? And again, on a hard drive that he was supposed to wipe clean? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0284. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0284. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for an next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.